This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson. We are discussing the RSO's Bach and Haydn concert on Saturday, January 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. The program begins with a couple of pieces. They're rather short pieces. Why did you select these two?
These two pieces were chosen. They're the relics of a plan for a season that I ended up abandoning. But I had this idea of featuring music on every concert that found its way into movies. And both of these pieces are featured in quite a number of movies, a number of very different movies. Because they have a kind of a character that makes them, I think, a little more interesting than just Baroque music ordinarily would be. Henry Purcell, the composer of the first piece, wrote this in 1694. Purcell died quite young. He died interestingly of a cold or something related to that, because after a night of drinking, he came home and his wife wouldn't let him in the house, and it was pouring rain.
Oh my gosh!
And he got sick. And died. But up to his death, and quite for a number of years after that, he was England's most famous composer until Handel came along. And of course, Handel was German, but they adopted him. So Henry Purcell, great English composer, writes this music for the funeral of Queen Mary in 1694. She was much beloved by the English. And this music was meant to be played outdoors. And what do you do outdoors? Well, strings generally don't deal very well with the weather. So he wrote what you might expect for an outdoor procession or something. He wrote for brass instruments, and only four of them. Two trombones, or actually as they were called at the time, sackbuts. A funny name, a very interesting name. Trombones came from sackbuts, which you would recognize by looking at them and say, that looks like a trombone, except that the bells are a little bit smaller. Trumpets, two trombones. The trumpets were what were called flat trumpets, were slide trumpets. They were played much like the trombone by moving a slide. And kettle drums. So two pieces from the funeral music. The first is a march, and has the distinction of being a very slow march, which you would think would be appropriate for a funeral. But the idea of it being slow gives it a particularly interesting character. If it were a fast march, it wouldn't be nearly as interesting as it is quite slow. And that ties into the next piece, too. Jean-Baptiste Lully is the most famous French composer of the Baroque era. Very much involved with Louis XIV and his court. Wrote a lot of dance music, wrote a lot of opera. And this particular piece is dance and incidental music that he wrote for the comedy by Molière, La Bourgeois Gentilhomme, or as is often translated in English, The Would-Be Gentleman. I think there's another version of that too. But anyway, you may have seen, some of the people listening to this may have actually seen the play. And he wrote it for a later scene, and I frankly don't remember it. I've seen the play, but I don't remember it. Maybe this was cut. But the ceremony of the Turks, I don't remember what that is, but what is important is that for Europeans in the 17th century, and even into the 18th century, Turks were very exotic, strange creatures. They had these fantastic mustaches that none of the other Europeans wore. They dressed in these strange clothes, and they had strange ceremonies, and they had very, very strange music. Their bands, their military bands, had instruments that weren't found in the European bands and orchestras. A lot of percussion, a lot of very nasal woodwinds. A lot of composers tried to imitate this. By the way, there's a word for this. It's called janissary music. J-A-N-I-S-S-A-R-Y. A lot of composers, including Mozart, wrote music inspired by this music. The Rondo a la Turk that people know of Mozart. Turk, the same Turks we're talking about in this particular situation, has a very exotic sound to it. Doesn't have the percussion instruments because it was just written for piano. But this particular piece has percussion instruments, a lot of jingling and jangling going on. And it is this march is also slow, which gives it a kind of a solemnity or gravity that it wouldn't have if it were faster. So these two pieces, I think, just are a little interesting. What do you call it when you go to a restaurant and they give you something, a little something to eat between courses, an amuse-bouche, something to amuse your mouth, to get this concert started. And it's music that comes from an earlier period than we usually play. This is the time that orchestras were just developing. Orchestras, as we know them now, really consisted of what was being used for opera, of which Lully was a great master. And it wasn't until really the early 18th century that operas, that orchestras as we know them, began to show up.
Now, these are particularly short pieces, too, are they not?
They are, just a couple of minutes each. The Purcell has more that goes with it, but it's choral. So we decided not to involve the chorus with this. We're just going to do the brass music.
Well, then we move on to Bach. And now, when Bach was alive, I believe he was known more as an organist than he was a composer. Is that not true?
Right. Well, first of all, it was given that anybody who worked for a church anywhere in Germany was going to be a composer, because that was part of your job, writing cantatas and motets and things for your church. He just wrote them like everybody else. The one important thing about Bach is that, especially towards the end of his life and even after he died, he was dismissed as a composer by most people because, he was just very old-fashioned and very conservative, and he was far outstripped by his sons, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach and Johann Christian Bach and Wilhelm Friedrich Bach, who were considered to be much more progressive and much more interesting as composers than the old man was.
Well, now, tell us about, you're going to be featuring the Brandenburg Concerto No. 5, mm-hmm. which is part of 6 concertos.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Give us some background on it, because it's very interesting. It's a very interesting story how they were developed.
Well, this is the late 1620, before Bach ended up getting to Leipzig, where he would serve at the Thomaskirche for years and years, which is most people know about him. He was looking for a job in a royal court, because that's where the money was. If you got yourself in a royal court, you got paid, you got an orchestra to play with. It was the ideal position. And he was working the Margrave of Brandenburg. The Margrave is a title of royalty you don't hear very much anymore. But he really wanted to be the court composer for the Margrave. So he put together 6 concertos as an example of his work, and included a very obsequious letter to the Margrave, groveling before him, before his Royal Highness, the Great Royal Highness. It's really almost sickening to me, the toadying that went on in that letter. And sent it to the Margrave, and the package was never opened. Therefore, except for whatever performance Bach may have done when he was trying out the piece, these pieces were never really performed, certainly not in public. And it wasn't years later, and I might be wrong, but I think it was after Bach's death that somebody finally opened the package and found these wonderful concertos, which have become one of the most famous parts of Bach's enormous output of works. Great chamber music from early years of the orchestra, really. All for different instruments, and sometimes very exotic or very strange combinations. This piece being a really good example. Concertos for more than one instrument were not uncommon. Vivaldi wrote a number of concertos for 2 instruments or 3 instruments. And Bach actually learned the concerto style from studying Vivaldi's music. But he wrote the 5th concerto for a solo flute, a solo violin, and a solo harpsichord. Now, let's start with the solo harpsichord part of this. This had never been done before. nobody, and I mean nobody, had written a piece that featured the harpsichord as a solo instrument. The harpsichord was considered part of the basso continuo. It played along with the bass and the cello and played the chords, filling in the harmonies. And there was always a harpsichord present, or in case of church music, an organ, but never featured as a solo instrument. Well, Bach, who was quite a crackerjack keyboard player, decided he was going to show something, create a showpiece for himself. So it's interesting, as this piece goes along, at the beginning you are aware that there is a solo flute, there's a solo violin, and yeah, the piano kind of has some interesting solo parts too. But as that movement goes on, the violin and the flute seem to recede into the background a little bit, and the harpsichord becomes more and more prominent, until finally near the end, there's an enormous solo cadenza for harpsichord that is very difficult and sounds very difficult, and is meant completely to show Bach's, show his own personal ability off as a keyboard player. So that's remarkable. The other remarkable thing, and this pertains to Bach's reputation as being very conservative, he writes this piece specifically for a transverse flute, depending on how you want to call it, which is the flute. It's made out of wood, but it's played the way we recognize flutes being played today, held up to the lips and then off to the side. In Germany, if you wrote a piece for solo flute at this time, it was assumed that you were writing for recorder. So this was a flute, an instrument that was very popular in France, and by bringing this in, he was again showing off how progressive he was in writing for this combination of instruments. The piece has become known as probably the most often performed of the six Brandenburg concertos, and is one of the most often performed of all of the early 18th century works for chamber works. This piece was written in 1720, probably. Don't know exactly. There isn't a date on the manuscript. It had to be before 1721 because that's when he presented the manuscripts to the Margrave.
And he got the job.
No, he didn't.
Aha! He did not get the job.
Probably for the better, because he wouldn't have gone on to Leipzig and written all those wonderful sacred works for chorus and orchestra and for soloists.
Then we move on to the final selection, which is Haydn's Symphony No. 103 in E-flat. And this is sometimes called the drum roll symphony. Why that name?
Because there's a drum roll. There are two drum rolls, as a matter of fact, but that's, of course, the simple smart aleck answer. You might think, why bother naming it the drum roll when you've got a perfectly good symphony title, Symphony No. 103? Well, that's the reason right there. When you write 104 symphonies, it's hard to keep track of them by the number. And by this time, many of Haydn's early symphonies had gotten names attached to them, describing a particular musical idea. There's a symphony called The Bear, because of a movement that sounds kind of like a waddling bear, The Philosopher, and quite a few others. And this starts out with a very obvious drum roll, timpani roll. But I think, why is that so strange? Well, today, it wouldn't be strange. Lots of pieces start out with odd things happening, and there's all sorts of different colors. The idea of opening a symphony with a timpani roll before proceeding on into the adagio that follows that was quite revolutionary and certainly got people's attention. And this is written at a time when, we got to remember, we think of the symphony now as being sort of a serious art form in which a composer pours his thoughts and his emotions into and expresses something. Not in this time. Symphonies were entertainments. This is something and a program that would possibly be done with an operatic aria or two or three, maybe a solo concerto, and then closing with a symphony. When that was kind of that was the main attraction, is a symphony. And Haydn got a chance to write his final 12 symphonies for two trips that he took to London, starting in 1790. Impresario named Salomon organized these trips. Haydn had just retired from his long service with the Esterházy house out in the boondocks in Austria. And his works were very well known throughout Europe at this time. He was the most famous composer in Europe. What about Mozart? Well, Mozart was not as well known as Haydn. Haydn was older. Mozart was also, as anybody knows, Mozart's life was not as well appreciated during his lifetime as he probably should have been. Haydn was, and I've always had this image of the old Haydn, Papa Haydn, being carted off to London in a wheelchair or something. And he was only 59 when he went on his first London trip. And he wrote six symphonies for that trip and went back a few years later and wrote the final six symphonies, in which this was the second to the last. That was met with very, very positive audience and critical acclaim. Just to go back to the title again, think about what the people in the audience would be thinking when, at the beginning of the piece, you're expecting, well, you're expecting strings. You're expecting maybe a slow introduction, because a lot of Haydn symphonies had slow introductions, but at least you're expecting the orchestra to play. And instead, timpani. What's going on here? What's he doing? And after that, of course, it goes into the strings start playing, and everything's normal, except right towards the end of the first movement, boom, the timpani comes back again, playing that role. And Haydn was known as having a sense of humor. This was probably one little thing that we might not think is funny, but I'm sure his audience thought was rather amusing.
Well, I think you answered the question of why it's called the London Symphony, or one of the London Symphonies, yeah, because of his where he was. You may have already answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why did you decide on this particular piece?
Well, I could have reached into a jar of all the London symphonies. As a matter of fact, I could reach into a jar with almost any of Haydn's symphonies and picked out a piece and said, well, I'm going to do this. Because we haven't done that many Haydn symphonies in the past. And I'm sorry for that. We should have done more. But this is a piece that hasn't been done for decades by the Rockford Symphony. And I thought, well, it's a good time to bring it out. It's a great piece. Acknowledged as one of Haydn's greatest symphonies. And if it's one of Haydn's greatest symphonies, it's one of history's greatest symphonies.
All right, now I've got to ask you this. The printed advertising pieces for this concert feature Bach and Haydn in leather jackets, looking like they're members of a motorcycle gang. Is that because they are rebels?
Oh, we found an ancient photograph. no, of course not. I think probably it's more they were certainly not rebels. Neither of them were rebels in any sense of the word. Haydn, in particular, who served the Prince Esterhazy for decades, he wore a livery, you know, wore a kind of a uniform like all the rest of the servants. So he was hardly a rebel. It's probably more of an advertising gimmick than anything else. I think it contrasts nicely with the powdered wigs that they're wearing.
Yes, I think it's super myself. Well, we certainly want everybody to experience Bach, Haydn, and many other things at the Rockford Symphony's Classics Concert on January 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. Now, for more information about this concert and more, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.